This show is my conversation with Shayna as Shayna and I reflect on my conversation with Brad Littlejohn. We're releasing both of these shows as a two-pack, and we don't even know which you should listen to first. It's up to you. You can listen to our reflection on the conversation and then listen to the conversation, or vice versa. Listen to the conversation first and then come here and hear Shayna's and my reflections. Please enjoy, and we hope you will find nourishing, fruitful, interesting, my and Shayna's conversation about my conversation with Brad. Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he is Chris Owen.
We are recasting the narrative of our shared common life by using the lens of moral philosophy and theology.
Trying to move the conversation in the public square past the binaries of politics and economics, which so often hamstrings the ideas, hamstrings the conversation, and therefore hamstrings our ability to actually move towards a place of human flourishing.
Yeah, if you really pay attention to the way that our shared common life is framed in media, even in your most favorite media outlets, just take a step back when you're listening to the news and hear the framework, hear the lens that these questions and conversations are framed in, and you will see, as I did, that it's so often simply the partisan political and the economic. And there are deeper ways. That's the claim of our project. There are deeper ways, more interesting ways to see what's going on in our shared common life, this metaphor of the lens.
There's also more interesting ways to have conversations about them, than agree, disagree.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll just say one more thing about this. Not that when we engage with moral questions that somehow, we will all find the common ground and find agreement. Rather, the idea is we'll find more interesting disagreement, more fruitful disagreement. And part of the skill of this is to be able to disagree and still be in relationship.
Yeah, I like to think of it, you know, in terms of creative interchange, which was Whitehead's theologian's construct that, you know, when another's reality becomes a part of our internal landscape, we can continue to disagree, i.e. we can continue to have our own perspective on something, a perspective that is not in agreement with theirs, but we have a better understanding of who they are and how they got to where they are. So a genuine appreciation for their position, even if it's not one that we share.
We have a spinny wheel that we, as a beginning ritual of our show, we give it a spin. It's a bicycle wheel, and on the bicycle wheel is mounted a sprinkler head that is a pointer. There are 16 different core values and key ideas. We give that thing a spin, whatever it lands on. Shayna and I do a riff. Shayna thinks it's a way for us to warm up to the show. I think it's anti-totalitarian practice.
And we describe the spinny wheel to you because if you're new to our show, we don't want you thinking we've got some sort of scientific or digital spinny wheel. This is real, authentic New Hampshire swamp Yankee.
It's analog.
It's analog.
It's not digital.
Definitely analog.
The spinning wheel has landed on narrative cultural therapy. One way that we conceive of what we're doing is changing the story. So narrative therapy is a therapeutic methodology where you work with a client and work towards reframing stories. And indeed, that's a way to understand what we're doing, Shayna. We want to tell a different kind of story about our shared common life and about the things that are happening within it.
I think of those conversations we've probably all had at some point in our lives where, you know, you were having a conversation with someone and and the conversation, each of you was contributing to something that was building and it was getting bigger and bigger and you got more excited, like, yeah, and then, yeah, you know, and so everybody's getting really excited. And in the process of that conversation, something is coming into being. And I think that most of the conversation we have in the public square about our shared common life is so abjectly depressing because of so much that's going on. That there really is no conversation of possibility, or there's very little conversation of possibility. So the therapeutic nature of this narrative cultural therapy for me is discussions that open up possibility where there wasn't one. Oh, much nicer than the hee-haw. And with that, tone signifies a change in direction.
I actually like that sound too, although it was a little bit fun to moo.
Yeah, to hee-haw, to whatever. You know, it's the bicycle wheel and the sprinkler head. We're getting precariously close to the clampets here, so I just...
That's why, yeah.
We upped our game a little bit with a fine piece of china.
We did. Transitioning to today's show. This show will be released as a two-pack with my conversation with Brad Littlejohn. Brad is the president and founder of the Davenant Institute. He's also a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C.
Can you spell Davenant for our listeners? Because when I heard it, when I heard you two talking, I couldn't figure out what exactly he was saying.
Davenant. D-A-V-E-N-A-N-T. It's interesting that the spinny wheel landed on cultural narrative therapy, because there's a place in my conversation with Brad where I actually say, well, Brad, I would tell a different story.
Yes.
About that particular thing that we're talking about. So, Shane and I have, obviously, I've listened to it because I was there. I listened to it while it was happening, believe it or not. And we're going to just do some commentary responding to the conversation that I had with Brad Littlejohn. Shane, I'm really curious some of the different things that you might have picked up on.
I'm going to start from the end and go back towards the front, because the one that had the most energy for me was the place where I found myself, I guess, in the deepest place of disagreement. And that was when I'm trying to frame this for our listeners. The two of you were talking about the decreased prominence that the church plays in American identity and in American public life. Brad had noted, in his opinion, it was the ecumenical movement which, in the interest of trying to bring people together, wound up inadvertently watering down identities. Watering down is my word, not his. Watering down the identities of various churches and denominations. And he was also talking about how the innovation of cars, you know, meant that people could church shop. They could go to a church that was farther away from where they lived. And so they're choosing a church rather than belonging to one that is like within their community. People, the idea is, you know, fundamentally that people seek an identity, that identities are crucial to our lives, and that the church, because of these watered down identities, the watered down principles and purposes, watered down ideologies, have left less for people to grab onto there. And so in the absence of churches and denominations having these strong identities, politics winds up taking over, which was his answer to your question about why churches today seem to be divided along political lines. But then Brad went into a very interesting, and I don't disagree with him on any of that, but where he talked about Democrats, he didn't name Democrats, one political party, but he was talking about Democrats doubling down on this identity of the human being as being self-created, is reason enough for evangelicals to go Republican, because that notion of individuals being self-created apart from God is fundamentally idolatrous, is a fundamentally idolatrous vision of the human being. And I found myself sitting there going like, whoa. And evangelicals' view of an individual like Donald Trump and his misogyny and his, you know, inability to keep a marriage intact and his multiple affairs and his disregard for the law or for democracy or for fundamental respect of anyone, you know, all, evangelicals are all fine with that. But woe unto the Democrats who, you know, have the audacity to perhaps see that a view of people as being self-created is not necessarily apart from God. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would argue and say, like, yeah, we're self-created because we have free will. We are constantly creating ourselves, and we are ultimately accountable for the choices that we make. And when we come before God, for those of us who, you know, carry that theology, it's not mine, but when you come before the Lord, you have to testify for your behavior. Who do you think is going to be responsible? I mean, you think, what are you going to do? You're going to come before God and say, I'm sorry, it was the Democrats' fault that, you know, that I totally screwed up or I'm fallen, or I, like, I don't think that's going to, I don't think that's going to carry.
Can I respond to that, or did you
That was one of the areas that really, and I thought a lot of his analysis was spot on. That was one place where I kind of went, hey, wait a minute. Because for him, it was all about, you know, abortion, you know, the Dems wanting abortion on demand, which is not true of all Dems. And although he didn't say it, I would imagine LGBT, you know, support of LGBTQ plus communities would also be on that list.
So two things. One is my maneuver. I don't know if you noticed this, but my maneuver in the conversation was to try to not get at, well, your political side or the side that you identify with politically does this and your side does that. I think that kind of conversation doesn't go very far.
Right.
So I don't know if you noticed, but what I tried to do was to
name
the moral questions that then are underneath. And that's really a basic piece of our project, is to try to name those moral questions that, or the theologically anthropological.
And you nailed it.
Okay, thank you.
You nailed it in the failure of the church to form people deeply in order for them to live in accordance with God.
So that's the, thank you. I'm glad that it came across to you as a listener that's where I was aiming, and that I,
you
to your
it up.
To your ears,
nailed
did
it.
That successfully. So I try not to take the bait in that, because I felt, I try not
you
to take the bait
you, yeah.
on that, because I feel like it's a trap in terms of conversation. The second thing, just to get to what you said, which I think, which I did not think of, but this whole sense of, so this gets in now into the content of this idolatry or ideology of self-creation, and you're raising just now, I mean, this, here, we need Brad now, part of the conversation, because you raised something that I hadn't thought about, which is this sense of, okay, where does our human freedom play out in this and in the choices we make, and you know, and human freedom, I understand theologically as part of what God has given us, made us to be. So there's a theological anthropology at work there as we understand what human freedom is and how it plays out. So to tie that up, my conclusion to my little moment here talking to you is, how interesting that you raise it. Now I'm really curious what Brad would say in response. And that's the kind, see, that That's not a political... See, I thought I was done, but here I go again. That's not a political conversation. It's not about your side and my side. It's about what is human freedom and how is that relating to the issues that are playing out on the political field, but are not fundamentally political. They're fundamentally about the human being is.
They're fundamentally theological, psychological, philosophical. But I think, as a process theologian, that notion of our free will, God meeting us at the forming edge of our lives, is one of the things that really differentiates process theology from a lot of other theology. As a process theologian, I do not see God as omniscient or omnipotent. A God who is all-knowing is basically nothing more than an autopilot, right? And a God who is omnipotent, all-powerful, lands for me kind of like a tyrant, you know? But the God who had the courage and the wherewithal to set all this in motion and then step back and say, I am here, but you have to seek me. You have to do your work in order to seek me and in order to find that harmonic convergence, that place where it all comes together, the place of righteousness and wholeness and fulfillment and love and compassion. It's not just going to be, we're not just going to spoon feed you. A friend of mine, a colleague of mine, has a blog that she writes called Hold My Chalice, sort of like Hold My Beer and Watch This. Hold My Chalice. And I love Kimberly. She doesn't pull any punches. And she puts it right out there the way that it is. She was talking about the guy who, you know, prayed every day to win the lottery. And he prayed every day. Every day he prayed to God to win the lottery, how it would change his life, how he promised to be a good servant with the resources that he'd be given and he'd share and he'd do this and he'd do that. And, oh God, if you would just, in every single day, this guy prayed to win the lottery. And finally, one day, God had it and came down out of the cloud and said unto him, dude, meet me halfway, would you? Buy a damn ticket. You know, and it seems to me like, in fact, this is where our churches are. People come and they want something to happen, but they're not doing their own work. They're not, you know, they're not like engaging. And I don't think the church is working hard to form people, as you talked about with Brad, to do that formation and then identity building piece, such that we would be asking ourselves more often than not, you know, when we have decisions and choices to be made, how does my faith play into this decision? I got to tell you, I mean, most of the people who I serve in my denomination, I do not think about that probably better than 97% of the time. You know, if I were to think about this as a person of faith, would that change my position? Would that change my choice?
I see you looking diligently at your notes. Was there anything else? Was there something else that you wanted to raise?
You know what I wanted to go deeper into, because it was just one of those moments in the interview that really made me go, is where he was talking about how it is that, you know, people say, oh, you know, religion and the scriptures are difficult to read. They're opaque. Our lives are clear. And he wanted to flip the table on that and say, you know, maybe the thing that makes it seem like the scripture is unclear is that the way you're living your life is not in alignment with the good that you know you should do, but do not.
I heard him say something a little bit different than that.
Oh, tell me what you heard him say.
I heard him say that Scripture is clear, but your life is opaque.
Mm-hmm. But why is your life opaque? He didn't get into that. I added that.
Yeah.
That I think I remember the first church that I served out of seminary, there was a minister who served there who he could preach, and his preaching was challenging. And this was the first Iraq war, and there were some people in the church who did not appreciate what he was saying. As they would frame it, what, we don't appreciate what he's saying about America's involvement in the war. And when I asked them to repeat to me what it is they thought they had heard him say about America's involvement in, you know, Iraq, invariably they were saying things that he did not say. He was preaching the gospel. And by preaching the gospel, it became painfully obvious that the role our government was going down could not in any way, shape, or form be justified as the Christian way. And rather than say, geez, it seems to me like I'm wrestling now with my politics because my politics and my religion are, you know, at crosshairs with each other, let's make the minister wrong because he's preaching a political, he's not preaching a political line. I never heard the man preach a political line in his life. He was preaching the gospel. And if the gospel jams you up and suddenly now, you know, you're all, everything is unclear and, you know, rather than delve into that, they wanted to simply put the, say that he was being political. He wasn't being political, they were.
That, no, I think that's a good example. To me, that rings authentic to the conversation I was having with Brad and the way I understood his point at that juncture. So, yeah, well, there's something juicy in that, isn't there, or not?
I do, because I think, you know, so much, you know, Chris, our tagline is to stay curious, to go deep, and to shine light. To stay curious in order to go deep, and to go deep in order to shine light. And all of that is about being able to broadcast those deeper core values. I think it's important for us as people of faith and or as ethical people who desire to live ethically and morally well with one another, that we're going to have to understand that a natural part of that is going to be running into these crosshairs, running into these places where we're conflicted. Was it Aquinas who said, the good that I would do, I don't do?
Might have been Augustine.
But the evil that I wish I didn't do, I do. And I think if we were to all just get still for a moment and be honest with one another, we all know that experience well. Just the innumerable times where we could have, would have, could have, should have done something differently, done it better. Part of the human condition is that this human life is messy and we're going to screw things up. That has to sort of be worked into the mix here because it cannot be. We cannot allow the conversation to stop at, you know, we hit the crosshairs, there's confusion, things get difficult or oblique, and then we just go screw it and walk away. Like, that's where you need to go, the ability to be self-reflective, to stop for a minute, to take a deep breath, to go deep within, to say, hey, wait a minute, there's a little bit of cognitive incongruence here. What's that, to notice it, to be aware of it, and then to stop long enough to ask oneself, so what's really going on here? Why am I wrestling with this so much? And or to have other people you can talk to about that, right? People who you trust to hold you accountable to your highest ideals. To have those conversations and be able to fetter things out and get beyond just the simple opinion, you know, but into something a little deeper.
Thanks for bringing up that part of the conversation and elucidating it. I think also it is a fruitful kind of, it's a little reversal. Like, it's this like little moment where he says, you know, you summed it up. Scripture is opaque. No, sometimes it's our lot. Scripture's clear,
right?
And our lives are opaque. I would just add this to what you said.
How was it? Somebody once said, billions of years ago, God created humanity in God's own image. And ever since then, humanity's been trying to repay the favor, right? To create God over in our image. Like, well, surely God hates all the people I hate, and God likes all the things I like and dislikes all the things that I like. Clearly, you know, I and God are one in the same, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add the word discernment then in terms of.
Discernment is the word.
So sometimes it's discernment about what God or what Scripture says. But this flip here is calling us to have discernment about the times we live in. And that involves some of the things that you've just enumerated, which can also include self-deception. Like, you know, like I'm fooling myself, or there are things that I'm hiding from myself that I don't want to be aware of, because if I were aware, then I would need to change. All of those things are dynamics in us as human beings. And then, of course, then thinking about, of course, our shared common life. There, a whole society can have these blind spots, not be able to discern the times, even when, if scripture is clear.
And when we engage in those conversations with one another, what we really need to be able to do is what you did with Brad Littlejohn, which is, you know, like when we get into those places in conversation with another, not to take the bait, but to keep going back to what are the ideals, you know, where are the ideals that we share, how, you know, or what is it I know to be an ideal for you, and how is what you're doing jamming that up or lubricating the wheels of it?
And or what are the tensions that we live into as human beings that are not resolvable?
Right. Damn.
But that if we can talk about them, we can see how to maybe hold them in tension together. Individuality versus the common good being one. Just as an example, there's no answer
right.
There's just living in tension, holding those together.
And that brings us beautifully right up onto the skids of perhaps the last topic that I wanted to bring up, and just see if you had anything that you wanted to, anything more that you wanted to say about the theology of trust.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was a really, that was a substantive portion of your conversation with Brad. Yeah. Communities.
This was a place where.
Trust networks. Building trust networks. That was fascinating. And I.
Can I just, before you go on this, let me just say, that's one of the pieces that attracted me to want to have this conversation with Brad. These networks of friendship and communities of trust. Yes.
Well, that conversation followed, it rolled out of the conversation that you guys were having about the separation between academia and the church. And one of the reasons I found that so fascinating is I had been thinking just the other day about how different the work of being a pastor in a church is to what we experienced in seminary. I mean, in seminary, I don't know about your experience, but in my experience and the experience of a lot of colleagues I've talked to, everybody's life unraveled. They went to one way, shape, form, or another, everybody's life unraveled when they went to seminary. People just encountered crises. And if you didn't encounter a crisis in your personal life, then you got to do clinical pastoral education, which threw you into the deep end of the pool, and you were in other people's crisis, such that the faith of your youth was challenged and most often crumbled into dust. I watched that happen over and over and over again. And what emerged from me was something so much bigger and better, more calories, fuller taste, remove stains. I mean, it was, it was the new improved theology, able to live 6,000 pounds with just one drop. It really was this amazing and powerful awakening. And I guess I thought on some level, this was what we were supposed to do or help facilitate in one way, shape, form, or another once we got into our churches. But of course, once you get into the church, you find out a couple of things, not the least of which is that most people really aren't thinking theologically at all. So I guess my point, Chris, is that, we talk about building communities of trust, that the church in some very real ways is in need of some radical transformation. Transformation, not change built on the past, but really kind of a, or maybe built on past, but a deeper infusion of formation and identity. I know a lot of folks blame the church, and I don't know who's to blame, and I'm not sure the blame game is going to help us anyway. But I think if we're to have a robust faith, it's because people have to come seeking a robust faith. You and I talk about this all the time, the sort of rampant nihilism that is everywhere. Everything is everything, and everything is just the same as everything else. And, well, that's just your truth, but there is no actual truth. And has just watered everything down to the lowest common denominator, and I'm not sure that's going to get us where we need to go.
Yeah. I need to ask you a question, Shana, about this. How do you, Shana, approach... There are Christians who believe that homosexual attraction is disordered and who believe that homosexual sex is immoral. How do you approach a person like that who has that perspective? Because this would be, I mean, let's just name it, right? This would be, I suspect, I mean, Brad and I didn't get into this, but he might hold those views.
What would be the point of that conversation? I mean, if that's just a fundamental place and, you know, about which that we disagree, there's really no point in having a conversation there.
Mm-hmm.
But in finding in, you know, trying to turn a conversation more towards the inherent worth and dignity of all people as being created in the divine image, you know, and we can pull out the sin of homosexuality if you want, put that one, you know, right at the center of the bullseye. But there's lots of sin. And if we're going to talk about that, then, you know, we can talk about it in a greater context. But, you know, if somebody is fundamentally in their mind has it that, and by the way, Jesus says nothing
right
about same gender loving. And I, you know, based on my relationship with Jesus, I'd say, you know, I think Jesus would look around and go, if you guys seriously think this is the biggest nut you have to crack right now, you're not paying attention. You know, while the planet is disintegrating, while too many people have no housing, are food insecure, like, hey, you know, knock it off. How about we simplify things? How about, I know, why don't we feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and visit those who are sick and in prison? And when we get all that down, then we can work on the next steps. But meanwhile, there's a whole lot of hungry people still out there, a whole lot of naked people out there. There's a whole lot of people who are alone and isolated out there. We haven't even done those things yet. So let's put everything else on a shelf and start working, you know, on the basics.
Mm-hmm.
That may be a duck out on my part, but I just have never found those conversations get us anywhere for the same reason that you said, you know, it's like you've got to change the nature of the conversation rather than digging into your bunkers.
Yeah. I want to see if I can do this succinctly, because I think there might be, now I don't know for sure, but I think there might be a way to have a fruitful conversation about this, which, because I think the stuck point is saying, well, if you think homosexual relationships can be blessed, then you aren't paying attention to morality, to sexual morality. That would be one hard view.
What does one thing have to do with the other?
I'm not saying that I agree with that. I'm just saying that that's a perspective.
Well, there's a whole lot of okay, you're not going to ask me to respond to that because I don't understand what that person would be saying about what is sexually immoral.
Let me get there. That's okay. Where I'm trying to go.
All right.
And I think there, so this is a little both sides-ism, which I think is appropriate in this case. The other side would say, if you believe that homosexual sex is immoral, then you are a homophobe. To me, these are two hardened positions that don't allow for dialogue.
Do you have to be a homophobe, or could you just be non-homosexual approving?
Exactly. I think you can be. So what I would say is that just because you don't find homosexual sex to be immoral does not mean that you don't believe in such a thing as sexual morality. And I think a sexual morality that makes sense takes into a, is more about fidelity and mutual care than it is about where
pelvic issues. Yes, we agree on that. Yes.
Yeah. And so to me, that's potentially a fruitful way forward, because then you can talk about morality without denigrating those who think that morality does actually have something to say about our sexual relations, and without denigrating those who don't see homosexual sex as immoral, because there's a different way to think about the morality than simply the pelvic question.
Yeah, I mean, it winds up landing at, you know, hate the sin but love the sinner.
Does it? I don't know. I've never had the conversation.
But I mean, maybe it would be interesting to have the conversation and see if movement, if anything moved, and if so, what?
Or if the, again,
because it's like the abortion issue, right? I mean,
yes,
so often
yes.
The conversation is pro or against, and
yes.
We never get down into the finer points.
To some finer considerations of moral dimensions that add some nuance. I think that's a great comparison. And I'm not so sure that there would be movement. To me, the possibility, and this ties it back to the very beginning of our conversation, which is, maybe we can have more fruitful disagreement that sheds some light, even if it doesn't change my opinion.
Yeah, I wasn't referring, movement in that context wasn't
okay.
about
yeah.
opinion. It was sort of like opening up space in our mind and
yeah,
our
yeah,
hearts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
still, there's an opening there.
Nice,
right?
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Thank you.
I may not change somebody's mind. That's
right.
Fine, but.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. And I think, I mean, that's significant. Like if we.
That's the whole game. That's what we're up to here, man. That is the whole nugget right there, is can we engage in those conversations that ground us in ethical moral constructs in such a way as we understand one another better and can hold the disagreements respectfully.
Yeah. Thank you for walking with me down that path.
Yeah. Stay curious.
Go deep, Shana.
And shine light.
Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. We are so grateful for our generous donors on Patreon, and we invite you to become one of our generous donors on Patreon by going to patreon.com. You can sign up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com, where you can find some really wonderful photographs of Shana and Chris and our associate producer, Brandon. Our website, whatingods.com, is Shana.
WHATINGODS.
Great to be with you today.
Always great to be with you, Chris.